Hi, folks. I'm Dan Dworkis, and this is the Emergency Mind podcast, a space where we bring together lessons from the emergency department and beyond about performance when it matters the most and applying knowledge under pressure. I am honestly like a little bit fanboying out here and incredibly excited to have Dr. Roger Kneebone on the podcast with us today. Dr. Kneebone has a like truly fascinating and polymathic career arc. He's been a trauma surgeon, a general practitioner, and most recently, and correct me if I'm wrong, I guess I'd call you a student of expertise or something along that line. He works across disciplinary boundaries, everything from music and magic to medicine and law. He jointly leads the Center for Performance Science at the Imperial College of London, which is a collaboration between the Imperial College of London and the Royal College of Music. And in 2019, he became the 14th Professor of Anatomy at the Royal Academy of Arts. He's also the author of Expert, Understanding the Path to Mastery, which I have my dog-eared copy of here, which is a truly incredible book and deeply worth reading. I reached out to Dr. Kneebone after reading the book and being just blown away and truly touched by it. There were things in this book that put words to feelings I've had in my own arc of training that I'd never been able to say before. So after that long, rambling introduction, Dr. Kneebone, thank you for joining the podcast.
Well, Dan, it's a great pleasure to be on your program, and I'm looking forward to our conversation.
Absolutely. I guess it's worth maybe a front attack on this, and then we can sort of work our way around it in a circle. But what is expertise?
It's a really interesting question and a difficult one to answer. I think I suppose I'm thinking of expertise as what it is that you need to become as good as you possibly can at something you think is really important. And there are many sort of variations on that word. There's expertise, there's becoming expert, there's being expert, all sorts of things. And in the course of trying to put ideas into a coherent form and write a book, I had to think about what being expert meant. And I started off by realizing that it's easier to notice when it isn't there than when it is, in a way, because true expertise, I think, is one of those things that, you know, it's kind of like the water that you're in when you're a fish. You hardly notice it. When it's there, it just seems natural. And when people who are very expert do things that you experience in their hands, it just seems to happen just as it should. And it's only when you start to think about it or start to try and do some of these things yourself that you begin to realize how extraordinarily complex it is and how much has gone on under the surface, so to speak. I start, and I think, too, it often lies in how people talk about their work. And I start my book, Expert, you mentioned there, by talking about when I went to see a taxidermist who was just finishing off a very beautiful sort of image in my mind I have of a clouded leopard and her cub. And this was something he'd been commissioned to do by, I think it was by a zoo when the animal had died and they wanted to stuff it, as we would say. And there was this creature that looked as if it was almost alive. And I asked him how he did it. And I've never forgotten the way he talked about his work. He said, "It's pretty straightforward, Roger. You know, what you do is, first of all, you get the animal and you take its skin off, and then you have to treat the skin so that it's flexible and pliable. And then you put it on one side. And then all you do after that is you just sculpt a clouded leopard that size and shape, and you put the skin back on." And I thought that was brilliant, because it just, that word just, you know, you just sculpt a clouded leopard exactly that size and shape. When to me, you know, sculpting any clouded leopard or sculpting anything, let alone a clouded leopard, let alone one that size and shape, is completely inconceivable. And so when somebody has got to the stage where they can, without boasting, but just in a matter-of-fact way, talk about their work like that, I think that's shorthand for a whole lot of stuff that in his case had been accumulating over 40 years or more, which allowed him to talk in that, offhand is the wrong way, but in that way, as it were, perfectly natural to be able to do that kind of work. And I think that sort of crystallizes something that has happened after you've been focusing very intently on something for an extremely long time. And it hides all the things that have gone wrong on the way and all the things you tried out and didn't work at, and all the things that have happened to you as you've gone through a process that is often frustrating and everything, until you end up at the point where you can just put the skin back to a clouded leopard that you've sculpted. And so I think there's something about the language people use and the fact that it's often very unassuming and the reverse of boastful and just matter of fact, but without being dismissive. It's a curious balance, but I think you can recognize it in people who are truly expert, because they are, in a sense, very proud of what they do. but in another sense, not at all boastful about what they do.
Hmm. I'm struck by these memories of starting to learn martial arts as a kid and even as an adult, and having people that were so much further down one version of the path or another than I was, you know, and you'd ask them, well, how do you do this? And they'd be like, well, you just, you know, you sort of, I don't know, you just kick, or you think about where their weight is and then you move their weight to somewhere else, as if that's the most natural thing in the world. As if I'd asked them, how do you speak, or how do you move your left leg, right? Well, they've been speaking and moving their left leg since the time that they were children. So it's this balance, like you said, about totally natural, only produced by absolute friction, stress, and hardship along the way, right?
Yes, and I noticed that when I was doing, you mentioned I did surgery at one stage in my career. I trained as a trauma surgeon. And the really expert trauma surgeons when I was beginning would be very impressive, because they would say, well, let's just put something around the, I don't know, some structure in the abdominal cavity that I'd learnt about from textbooks, but never seen when it was covered with blood and, you know, all the anatomy was distorted. But they were able to recognize things and recognize things in a particular context and know what was the best thing to do and then be able to do it. And the way they talked about their work was not at the level of, this is really difficult, we need to get the blood controlled so that I can see what I'm doing. No, they would say, we will just develop the plane behind the second part of the unit, or you know, some sort of thing that showed that their way of seeing things was not my way of seeing things, because they were seeing through difficulties and challenges and distortions and abnormalities and all sorts of things caused by injury to what needed to happen next. And I thought that was a similar instance of becoming expert, where all that stuff that you yourself have gone through for a long time and the things you've got wrong and had to put right and everything, that sort of crystallizes in your being able to take a much more simplified view. Maybe simplified isn't quite the right word, but a clearer view, a less cluttered view, I would say, of what needs to be done. What are the essences of a situation?
Yeah, that's an interesting tension about simple versus clear, right? It is a bit, it certainly is less cluttered. It is often simpler, but not in a reductionist sense, in the sense of
well, simpler
here are the landmarks.
Simpler is certainly not the same as easier. I think less cluttered in a way is quite a helpful way of thinking about it, because, you know, it's less cluttered physically, but it's also less cluttered by uncertainty or ambiguity or that sort of thing. And I think that less cluttered works both physically and metaphorically, if that makes sense. And so the expert view of things is being able to straight to the heart of what the issue is and be clear about that, or perhaps narrow it down to one or two, but to have a clear picture of what is the problem or the challenge that needs to be dealt with. Mm.
There are a couple of layers here and a couple of frames that are worth putting together. And one of the really wonderful things about your book is that it leaves these signposts for us, whether we are on the path to becoming expert at something or whether we are guiding people behind or next to us about moving down that path. And I want to talk through some of the framework of that. Before we go there, I think it's worth maybe drilling down for a second, because there's these layers of expertise about this. And there's the difference between, I'm not sure I even have the language to finish this sentence, so I might have to lean on you here, but the expertise level of being a surgeon or a musician. And these are people that have mastered a wide variety of techniques, of theory, can connect the dots and improvise between things, and are able to see things that don't quite exist yet or that don't exist in front of them. And then there's also, in a more constrained or nuanced sense, there's expertise at doing a particular thing, right? So in the Mission Critical universe, we talk a lot about the tacit knowledge transfer problem, right? So you know how to ride a bike, but you don't necessarily know how to teach somebody how to ride a bike. There's not really the language for that. They have to sort that through on their own. And there's the small problem of, how do I learn to do a skill, whether that's suturing or taking a corner or whatever it is. And then there's the larger problem of, how do you become a person that is capable of doing these types of things? So first off, am I reading that right from your perspective, that there are those sort of like different constellations of things?
Yes, I think there are. And I think becoming expert is something that happens in layers. And it's a bit like layers of varnish, I suppose. You know, you do have to lay down sort of foundational skills, I think, and in whatever area, whether it's learning to play a musical instrument, as you say, or whether it's learning to do operative surgery, or whether it's in medicine, whether it's learning to work out with somebody what the issue is. And at first, your framing of what the challenge is often quite sort of focused, and it might be on a particular procedure, it might be on how to take blood or put in a cannula or something like that, or it might be playing a particular difficult piece of Chopin or whatever it is. When you're struggling with that, I think that seems to you to be the primary challenge. That's what the work seems to be about. But once you've got that under your belt, and once you've done that enough times for you to become reasonably confident that you can cope with that in all its many forms, you know, people with, if you're putting in a cannula, big people, little people with easy veins, people would say, once you've done that, then you start to think perhaps more widely about the nature of the work that sometimes requires you to do that component of it. And then as things go on, you might think how that relates to other aspects of you yourself, you know, how you, what it's like when you're trying to do that when you're very tired, or when other people are watching you, or shouting instructions at you, or whatever it might be, or whether there's great uncertainty because it's on the side of the street and a car's run into a lorry, you know, all these things. And I think these things build up gradually, don't they? And I think that when you're at a particular stage, you think that the stage that you're at is the thing. But the more you do, the more you realize that is one of many layers, one of many levels to it. And I think that's one of the interesting things about thinking about it in terms of not only the acquisition of specific skills and component parts, but what happens to you as you gradually put all these things together and make sense of them, and then be able to become able to do different things. And then one of those different things that you become able to do is to support other people. First of all, perhaps you are teaching them things that you think they need to know how to do and they don't yet, but you do, and you show them. But then perhaps later on, you're thinking more widely about whether this is the sort of thing that they would be best be doing at all, or what are the kind of particular challenges you think they need to have experience of, and how you could guide them towards opportunities for doing that. You know, you're thinking in a different way because you're then thinking about them and what they need to progress, rather than taking for granted that the things that need to be done, like putting in cannula, can be done, because you've freed up your scope of thinking, I suppose. So do you think more widely? Do you think that makes sense?
I do. I think layers of varnish is a wonderful way to describe it. I also think that there's this sort of expanding sphere of awareness around you, right? Like, you're maybe focused, ultra focused almost, on whatever the task is you're doing. And then as you're describing, when that becomes a thing you can do, then you start connecting the dots, and you're the star, and then you're the constellation, and then you're the galaxy, and then you're the Milky Way, or whatever the version of that is. And there's this somewhere in there, and I know you talk about this in your book as well, there's also the changes that are happening to you as you spend more time on this path and with this work, right? And there's that Seneca quote about a gem is polished by friction and a person is polished by their trials, right? So there's...
Yeah, and I think that's absolutely right. And because I think that you can think of this as individual tasks that need to be done, and people getting better and better at doing those tasks. The other way of thinking about it, though, is to think about what is the progression that we go through as we become more experienced and more skilled, and what are the skills that we, the interstitial skills, as you said a bit earlier, I suppose it's a good way of putting it. What are the things that go with or that stem from all those skills that you, those component skills that you learn? Because the whole thing is made up not only of the skills themselves, but of the processes that we go through in order to acquire those skills. And I think that's one of the interesting things, because that happens chronologically. And it's not a binary thing, either you can put in a cannula or you can't. It's how you cope with the process of reaching a point where you can confidently do that, whatever the circumstances. And I think that we see this in all kinds of areas of expert practice. Now, I guess it's particularly evident to you and me in medicine, because that's the world that we have grown up in, but you see it in every area of expert practice, I think. And that was one of the reasons, really, that I wanted to think about what might be a way of explaining, what might be a way of getting at the sort of inside story of what it is to become expert, rather than an external view, a descriptive process of looking at people who can't do anything, and then you see them do stuff for a long time, and at the end they're very good. That is an oversimplification, I think, which really doesn't take into account the things that we all of us go through from the inside. And so you can get quite a lot of that from talking to people, but the only person you can really get all of it from is yourself, because you're the person you're with all the time, and you're the person who has access to your inside thoughts. And so that was one of the things I was trying to do in this book, was to try and set out what some of these aspects of the process might be, and what are the bits that, in a sense, often only make sense retrospectively, and at the time seem pointless or tedious or whatever, and trying to make sense of where to draw the line between things that actually are pointless and tedious very often, but they just have to be done, and right, things that are both pointless and tedious, but also contribute to your development as you become more and more expert. And I think that there's something useful about, you know, I don't think I could have written about this in the way that I have when I was 21.
Sure.
Or 31, because I hadn't done those things, let alone had the opportunity to talk to lots of other people who had also done those things, but in different fields. And so I think there's something about this difference between an explanatory account and a descriptive account that, to me, was very interesting.
Yeah, there's almost like the outside view being the, you know, Hollywood montage of somebody training, right? You think about Rocky or something, and goes from nobody to somebody that can do a thing, and you just see these staccato moments of the pieces between it, and the inside view feeling very different, right? I don't know about you, but it never felt like a montage for me when I was trying to learn something.
It never did for me, and it still doesn't, but that sort of idea that it's a linear process, and of course it isn't. It's a sawtooth process, isn't it? You get all sorts of things happen on the way, and sometimes you fall off completely, and sometimes you go, you know, all sorts of things can happen.
Yeah, and it's worth saying out loud that that's actually quite normal, right? So when you're describing, like, you know, the difference between I can put an IV or a cannula in and I can't, right? That's not a, like you said, that's not a zero or one, right? That's maybe today I can sort of get it in this part of the universe, but over here I can't, and I don't know why. And then you go over here and you try to learn why, and maybe that's you or maybe that's them. And so there's this ebb and flow to your ability to match your skills to the challenge, to even understand what the problem is. I think that's quite challenging to be in that moment, right? You're using so much energy, you're pushing the, you know, you talk about the zone of proximal development, right? Like, you're really pushing your ability to match your skills against the problem at hand. And there's this ebb and flow about whether or not you can do it. And I think it's worth saying, if you're a trainee of any sort and you're listening to this, that's actually quite normal, right? Like, that's like what it is for all of us. It just doesn't necessarily look like it, because we are used to the story of the young hero who accomplishes task A and then B and then C and then goes on to, you know, fight the dragon or whatever it is. But that's not quite
like that in real life, is it? Yeah. And that was one of the reasons I had for drawing on my own experience in various ways, because, as I say, I had sort of privileged access to my own experience in a way that I didn't have to other people's. I mean, many people were very generous in what they told me, but of course they were deciding what to tell me and what not, and what they wished to disclose, but also what they thought was salient and missed, I'm sure, a whole lot of other things that I would have found interesting, but that they didn't think to talk about. And so I think getting that balance between an insider perspective and an outsider perspective, and then a whole lot of stuff written by people who may or may not have done stuff themselves, but were very good at marshalling ideas and writing in a different way. And so trying to put all that together to come up with an account that made sense of the nature of the work that happened at different stages in this pathway, from starting off knowing nothing about it, and you know, that I used this certainly in the UK, this long-standing Western European model of apprenticeship, I think, is widely familiar. The apprentice, journeyman, master trajectory, and of course, not using those words in any gendered sense these days, but nonetheless, the fact, the idea that you start off doing things that somebody else tells you, whether you like it or not, usually you don't, but you have to do it anyway, because that's the deal. And you spend ages and ages doing stuff in other people's workshop or whatever. And then you get to the point where you can go and make an independent living at it as a journeyman, as it used to be called in the medieval guilds, when you would go across the country and make your living journey out of the work that you'd learned to do. And then eventually, after several more decades, you would be sufficiently experienced and wise to set up your own workshop and have apprentices of your own. And so things would continue. The wheel would continue to turn. And I think that that is quite a useful model in some ways, because it makes it clear that there are stages and that it takes a long, long time. But what it doesn't make clear is what goes on in each of those sections, really. It makes it look very simple and uncomplicated, and actually it's anything but. And so what I tried to do was to look at what are the characteristics of the experience in each of those sections, apprentice, journeyman, and master. What were the things that were, what were the really important things that were going on at each stage? And then thinking, how might that act as a sort of an explanatory lens almost for looking at areas of expert practice and seeing perhaps what people were struggling with or what they were particularly good at, and how that tied in to people doing whatever they could to achieve the highest level of mastery that lay within their power. But looking at that as a long, pretty much a lifelong process.
Right.
With, you know, sometimes possible to see where it starts, but never possible to see where it ends.
Yeah, absolutely. Never possible to see where it ends, because you and the work evolve the more time you spend with it.
Exactly, yes. I think you put your finger on it. Both you and the work evolve. So it's a continually changing landscape in several dimensions, isn't it? So, which makes it inexhaustibly fascinating, but also quite difficult to write about.
What an amazing, you know, I know we're talking about more than medicine, but, you know, what an amazing way to describe medicine: inexhaustibly fascinating and also quite difficult. Right? Just the understated sort of.
Yes, I think the things that are, one of the things that fascinated me was that the things that at the beginning as a medical student that I would thought would be the most difficult things turned out not to be the most difficult. I mean, they were difficult at the time, you know, all that memorizing and stuff. But actually, that wasn't really what turned out to be either continually challenging or continually fascinating.
Mm-hmm.
Because a lot of that was knowledge that was external to me, or information that was external to me that I needed to memorize, or at least know where to find it if I needed it. And that in itself isn't a particularly interesting process, I don't think. You're stocking your informational larder with a whole load of stuff, and you need to know where that stuff is and where it is and where to find it and how to refresh or renew it if you need to, and where to put your hand on it when you require it. But actually, that process isn't a particularly interesting one. The process that is really interesting is working with individual people to try and make sense of what is really concerning them. I found certainly as a trauma surgeon, it was often quite clear what was concerning them or what was concerning the system about them, because they came in seriously injured or wounded or something. But in primary care, general practice as a family doctor, as you would say, I think in the States, a GP, general practitioner, in this country, very often the challenge wasn't so much knowing what to do about a particular problem, but working out in collaboration with another person what that problem was.
That
requires a different kind of knowing, I think, and a different kind of sort of comfort with not knowing as well. Because the thing that you're not knowing to begin with is perfectly legitimate for you not to know, which is what somebody else's central problem is.
Right.
And there may be times, and there often were times when there were particular things about that problem once we worked out what it was that needed the kind of knowledge that I had and the patient didn't have, or I knew how to get and the patient didn't know or how to get, in which case that was straightforward. Then we got that knowledge and applied it. But quite often it was different. It was something that we needed to work collaboratively in and say, well, neither of us really know, you know, here's how we framed the problem and we agree that that's what the starting point is. How we deal with it, you know, particularly when it wasn't a sort of obviously medical, it might be a social issue or an educational issue or all kinds of things. And then, you know, we could both find ourselves in uncharted waters, really. Then the essential thing, well, then as always, the essential thing was the relationship between, essentially a relationship between a clinician and a patient, which, as time goes on, I started to think of more and more as a collaboration between a performer and an audience.
Mm-hmm.
Roles which I think continually flip
mm.
and switch within a consultation or an encounter.
Mm.
So what I've been thinking about more a lot recently is what comes into view and what becomes blurred and takes a step back when we think about the clinical consultation as a close-up live performance with a very small audience, and then start to think about what is that relationship between performer and audience. I mean, for example, right at the moment, we're doing this on Zoom, of course, but I'm talking and you're listening. And in a way, I'm a performer and you're my audience, but in a second or two and a few seconds ago, it was the other way around.
Sure.
And you were performing and I was, you know, so there are all these issues, which nobody ever mentioned when I was at medical school, certainly, which
right.
I think go to the heart of what it is to strive to become expert. Because one of the characteristics of experts is that they are so skilled at managing or conducting or shaping these performer-audience relationships that it isn't at all obvious that it is a performance at all. It's just whatever it is. It's just a consultation, or it's just two people working together on a problem, or it's whatever it is. And so it's another instance of the art that conceals art, I think.
There's a billion different directions to go with this. I'm reminded of, I think it's the French painter Soulages, who talks about the idea that every painting is a conversation between the painter, the viewer, and the work itself. And that three-way component of it is started by the painter at some point in time, picked up by the work, and then continued by the viewer later in life. And you never really get to know what the next sentence is that happens, because there's this constant flow of differences in how the viewer sees it and how the art has evolved and everything. And just a really beautiful image for that.
I think that's a very beautiful image, yes. And it made me think of conversations I've had with one of my colleagues who's a close-up magician, very expert close-up magician, who has talked to me about how he designs a magic trick. This is with, you know, very small audiences, two or three
sure.
people, or maybe 10 or 15. Knowing that, as he puts it, each magic trick happens three times: when you see it, when you think about what you've seen, and then when you tell somebody else about it. And each time, of course, the story changes and the things that you remember become different. And magicians, of course, are very skilled at arranging things so that the things that you remember are the things that they want you to remember, the things that are inexplicable. And the things that you don't remember are the little tiny things that the magicians do to make that happen.
Sure.
And it did make me think that, you know, and what he says is that, you know, people very seldom remember the details of a magic trick, but they do remember how it made them feel. And I think that something very similar goes for clinical consultations, where people, I mean, it's well known, isn't it, that people, and nobody remembers what the doctor said, particularly if they were very ill or something difficult, but everybody remembers how the doctor made them feel.
Sure.
And I think that there's something there about paying attention to how you want people to remember and have experienced that encounter in retrospect, as well as doing the right things at the time. And that requires an awareness, I think, of that performer audience relationship. And this is not doing anything inauthentic. It's just shaping and emphasizing and making sure that the right things happen, that will stick in people's mind. And I think it's obviously good from a magician's point of view if people think kindly about what happened there. But it's crucially important very often if we're having very difficult conversations with people who are very seriously ill or whatever. You know, this has all sorts of long-term implications for how a single encounter builds, you know, repeated encounters build into a developing relationship, which can be crucially important at particular times in people's lives, especially with serious illness and all the things that we have to deal with.
I think you're highlighting, among other things here, that one of the arts of a master, or one of the signposts of a master in some sense, is being able to think around the corner to what's going to come next, and to project the actions that you do now onto their potential future arcs and their future paths. you know, one of the problems that we work with a lot are these spontaneous self-assembling teams in the emergency department, right? So a patient becomes sicker than expected, and you have a group of people that swarm together to try to solve the problem. The way that one of the things that I'm pretty continually working with my residents, my registrars about, is the idea that the way they handle themselves in these moments creates these ripples in these future relationships. Certainly it matters for the patient, 100%. But it also creates these ripples that matter for tomorrow's interactions and the next week's interactions. And even beyond that, you're not just you and, you know, it's not just Roger and Dan talking. It's Roger, the surgeon, Dan, the emergency physician. And the way that we represent, you know, to continue the apprenticeship model, the way that we represent our guilds and the way our guilds talk to each other makes these huge ripples that keep going. So you sort of are viewing, to get back to the earlier thread, you're zooming out and seeing your actions and your work, not just in the immediate context, but future around the corner and also in the broader environment that it happens in.
Yeah, I think that's right. Absolutely. And I think that looking around the corner is something that's quite difficult to do earlier. It needs quite a lot of freed up attentional capacity
Sure.
to think in that way. And we're having this conversation as Roger and Dan, who've both been around for a while and done quite a bit of stuff, I'm sure. Mm-hmm. I think when you're trying to remember what drugs you need to give when somebody's had a cardiac arrest, at certain times you are so focused on specific Sure. things with knowledge and skills that are not yet completely secure that it's quite difficult to think, for everybody to think round corners all the time. Mm-hmm. And so there's something about people at particular stages, particular sort of further on in their careers, perhaps, shouldering more of the burden of thinking round the corners and doing some of the sort of head it off at the pass and do it in advance because you know it'll be important later stuff that takes a bit of, you know, you need long distance glasses Sure. to really see some of that. That's interesting. One of the things I've worked out in this book, looking at this pathway and trying to look at it from the inside, speaks to that, I think, because, you know, in the apprenticeship phase, I think, you know, you are doing what other people tell you and you are focusing on tasks that people give you and you think that the task is the thing. Mm-hmm. And of course, at that stage, the task is the thing mm-hmm. Because that's the bit of the bigger picture that you've been given to do. And I think very naturally you're thinking about yourself. But then later on, when you become independent, I think I mentioned looking at this trajectory, two big changes that I think need to happen. And one is I've called is not about you, it's about them, and which is this idea that you are not the primary focus. And at the apprenticeship stage, it does seem as if you are. And if you are learning to tie secure surgical knots in or whatever it is, or make buttonholes or something, if you're a tailor, then yes, I mean, it is you making buttonholes that is the focus there. But actually, when you come to do the work, it isn't really about you. It's about whether you can do the work that is required for whoever the work is for. And so, you know, the fact that you've done loads of stuff and passed loads of exams doesn't really cut much ice unless you can help individual people with whatever's wrong with them. And that Sure. requires a different set of skills very often. You have to park a whole lot of stuff at the door and recognize that the primary point of attention or focus is somebody else, not you. And in the audience performer thing, then the emphasis shifts from you as a performer to somebody else as audience and how they perceive Sure. it. But at the same time, it is about you because this is exactly the time when you are going through a whole lot of things that you didn't do when you were in the sheltered environment of somebody else's workshop or clinic or whatever it is. And you're out there and of course you're making mistakes and you're getting things wrong and you're having to do a whole lot of stuff. And all of that contributes to you developing your uniqueness mm-hmm. as, you know, you're not an interchangeable emergency room physician. You're Dan Dworkis and you're Sure. different from all the other ones. And you will have characteristics and people will admire you for particular things, or they'll trust or distrust you for other things. They will make judgments about you because of where you've got to. And you can't ignore that, and nor should you. But keeping that balance between a laudable focus on your own individuality and how you can develop as fully as you possibly can, but keep that in check when there is a danger of over-focusing on you and under-focusing on the people your work is for. And if you're a performing artist, that's, of course, when you start to strut around and think you're more important than your audience. And if you're a clinician, it's when you think that you know, what's bothering you is more important than what's bothering your patient. And I think that's a, you know, that's a human process of having to, as a growing up, really, isn't it, in a sense? But it's one of the things that you often, although not always, see in people who've got to an advanced stage in their career. I think it is something that you really do see in people who are what I would call truly expert. But you can get people who are very senior, very powerful, and very high up in their institutions who haven't actually
made that
transition. All those things. Yeah, they haven't got a good balance.
Yeah.
At least that's how I see it. I don't know. Does that make sense to you, do you think?
I think, to go back one second, you talk about the beginning phases of apprenticeship when you're doing tasks that were like, this is the part of the universe you were assigned to work on at the moment. And I think there's, in your book, you make the really worthwhile point that it's not just the task you're doing, but you're developing your senses. You're developing your understanding of what right feels like. You're developing your intuition for what is a normal space in there. And that's difficult to transmit other than by direct physical action for it, by direct repetition.
I think you can't transmit it without, I think you have to be immersed in it. And there are physical aspects to it. You need to know, in our world, let's say you're learning to put in a cannula or something like that. You need to learn what different patients feel like, how they respond particularly. You need to know what different veins are like, what it's like, you know, different bodies, different. Of course you need to do that. You also need to know what it feels like when you try to do something that hurts somebody.
Exactly.
And you're not very good and you hurt them much more than somebody more experienced do, but you've got to do it anyway. You've got to learn all these things about how to do stuff. But one of the things you do learn is what these different physical experiences are like, what different objects are like, what different people are like. And you also learn what it's like to work with different colleagues and to work with nursing colleagues, perhaps, who go, or whatever, you know, if you're not doing, or people who are supportive and things. And you also need to learn what it's like to do stuff when you're bored and tired.
Absolutely.
And you wonder why the devil you're having to do it at all. But the reality is that you need to learn how to do things. You need to have the experience of doing things that make you bored and tired, because that's what an awful lot of work is. And you have free pass, really, to do work that doesn't involve being bored and tired. And I think that's a really difficult one. And as training programs get squashed a lot, there's a danger of not experiencing things that you may not like at the time, but that actually are important in progression towards becoming more and more expert.
For sure. And all of that links to what you're saying about, you know, watching not just the physical interactions, but the interactions of the room, the interactions of the other people, how they are seeing themselves, you know, vice their patients and their counterparts. And I think that threads nicely into this idea of, okay, well, which perspective are you taking as you're doing your work?
And I think being able to switch perspectives, but I think also that, you know, in the same way as when you're beginning to, I mean, my experience when I was beginning to do operations that I hadn't done before, I would be focusing very intently on what I was doing with the two or three people around me, maybe my assistant ops, me, the scrub nurse, of course, next to me, or whatever. And anything could have been happening in the rest of the operating theatre, and I just didn't notice it. But gradually, I would become more and more aware of the body language of the anaesthetist and the other people in the operating theatre, who was coming in, who was going out, what kind of conversations are going on. All that kind of thing. And that was all part of recognizing the health or otherwise of the team, I think.
Exactly. And picking up on those currents.
Picking up on those things. And that's a bit about, you know, that's a sense of being aware of your audience again, isn't it?
Absolutely.
And picking up these small cues that can really give you a sense of important things that you need to know about, which at an early stage, you just blank out.
Yeah. Can I toss you a bit of a curveball that I've been wrestling with a little bit here? So I had the experience and the opportunity not too long ago visiting the UK to work with the folks at Bremont Watches. And they brought in a gentleman to come speak to us who was an expert watchmaker. And he described his apprenticeship of learning to make watches. Fascinating. Definitely followed the arc that you're laying out in this. What was interesting about it, one of the many things, was comparing watchmaking and the art of becoming a master watchmaker to medicine, or to, and you can sub in here anything else in the Mission Critical universe, wildfire or special forces or the work from NASA. But one of the real differences is the rate of change of the universe around us. So certainly watchmaking has improved in the last however many years, but the way that medicine is changing at such a pace that in many cases, both the expert and novice are learning a new situation together at the same time. Right. So that certainly happened with us in COVID, when the ways our patients were behaving physiologically were outside what many of us had come to expect. We see it with the introduction of AI and with the changing machines that a lot of our teammates work with. So there's this situation where I might be an expert and a master at this, but also I'm faced with a situation that is really the leading edge of what is known by anybody. And I'm facing it with my students and my teammates at the same time. So how does that work? How do we do that? How do we teach people? Does apprenticeship still fit that model? When you're pushing at a universe where the rate of change is so fast, what, if anything, do we do differently as we become expert?
It's a very interesting point. I suppose since things are changing so fast, people quite quickly get quite a lot of experience in things having changed a lot, don't they? So, I mean, you, sure. You know, you've seen a lot more things change quickly than your students sure. will. And for them, the key thing might be COVID or AI, but you've seen loads of things. You know, and I was thinking back to my own experience with surgery. That was in the 1980s. And while I was doing it, you know, to begin with, when I was doing it, an awful lot of people would come in with perforated duodenal ulcers. And you'd be operating in the middle of the night. And then came HT receptor antagonists. And, you know, at sure. a stroke, all those incredibly complicated operations, so, you know, vagotomies and highly selective and super highly selective, all those things would just suddenly went out of the window. And so I started to see that a sort of changing landscape, which to me had seemed, initially, it had seemed as if my task as a learner was to learn how to do things as they had always been done. But I began to get the sense that it wasn't quite like that. And then I went to, as I said, then I finished my surgical training, and then I, for almost 20 years, I was a family doctor. And then I came back into a department of surgery at Imperial College London, one of the big London universities where I am now, and into a department of surgery, not as a surgeon, but as looking at in terms of surgical education. And when I came back, the landscape had completely different because it changed, because in the meantime, this was the 1980s, 1990s had happened, and keyhole surgery
sure.
had come, which changed everything in all sorts of, well, not everything, but it brought about convulsive change. And then I remember when I first joined Imperial, the head of our department invited me into the operating theatre to see him carry out, I think it was Europe's, certainly the UK's first robot-assisted laparoscopic cholecystectomy using a Da Vinci robot.
Sure.
And I think that was in 2000, but about 3 or 4 years ago, I was invited by the London Science Museum to curate an event around that very Da Vinci robot, which then became an acquisition of the Science Museum. So in 20 years, this way of doing things had moved from being, it was so space age and so new, it appeared in a James Bond film at that time when it was,
right.
you know, it was really unimaginably new. 20 years later, it had become obsolete and was in the museum. And so it made me think that, you know, these arcs are always happening. I think they're accelerating.
Sure.
And in a given time frame now, more of them would have happened. But I think that they are a sort of characteristic of any kind of practice, probably, but certainly surgical medical practice, that you only see when you take a few steps to the side and look at it in a longitudinal way. You don't notice it when it's happening to you in the moment.
Sure.
And so I think, to go back to your point about, you know, the rate of change of the universe around us, absolutely. I think that as teachers and educators, the task now is not to help people absorb and replicate something that is stable and has always been as we see it now, but how to make sense of continual change and how to remake the environment around us in the context of what we know about how people become expert. And one of the things that now becoming expert it consists of, I think, is making sensible choices about things that are changing and becoming more and more skilled at making reasonable decisions in the face of incomplete or rapidly changing information. And this business, the things that happen inside about, you know, knowing that the decisions we make now will look very different in certainly in 10 years, but also perhaps in 1 year or a month, and that we have to live with the consequences of the decisions that we make today, recognizing that later on they may look like the wrong ones. That is part of the human experience of working in a rapidly changing world.
Yeah. I love that so much, the way that you're capturing that. I think that identifying that part of becoming expert is learning how to handle changing, uncertain environments around you, and that it's not developing all of the skills that it takes to do it. It's developing the core set that allow you to expand and improvise and adapt and push the field forward around you, right? That you're remaking the work as you're going. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think some people are particularly good at that. And those people you see who are responsible for making particular discoveries or changes. And I was very fortunate about 10 years ago in working with some of the pioneers of keyhole surgery, by the time I met them, they were in their late 80s, sometimes early 90s. And I did some interesting work reconvening surgical teams and getting them to reenact operations that they'd done 30 years ago, often using equipment that they still had in their basement from those early days. And that was very interesting talking to them, because that sort of reanimated that experience of doing stuff that was very uncertain. And we did some stuff with Mr. John Wickham, who was a pioneering urological surgeon who had done the first percutaneous nephrolithotomy, actually, in UK ever, you know, and started, really kicked off a lot of this stuff about keyhole surgery. And we reenacted an operation with him and his scrub nurse and his anaesthetist and his various colleagues, all in their sort of later years. He was, I think, 88. And we brought together all these bits of equipment that, you know, they'd had in their basements for years and years, and they didn't really work very well. And I felt apologetic about it. I said, look, you know, we're having to stick these things together with sellotape and try and make them work, and we don't know what's happening. I'm so sorry. And they said, oh, don't worry, it was exactly like that in the 1980s when we were doing it the first time. And I thought that was really interesting, because there's something about that, something that looks fixed, polished, and complete from a distance, which at the time is always messy, uncertain, unpredictable, and often high risk.
You use this phrase on your book about thin materials on the verge of collapse. And that has stuck with me so well, because it captures this idea that when you're really pushing the edge, you are always going to be held a little bit together by duct tape. And your work, your team, your everything is always going to be right on
that. And if you're going to do your best work, you are always there. And that came from a ceramicist colleague of mine talking about you know, shaping the neck of a clay pot. But I think that it has, you know, it works very well as a metaphor for all sorts of things, because unless you're approaching that point of collapse, you're not doing your not doing your best work. You're not getting the best out of yourself or your materials. But there is always the danger that it will crumple and you'll go too far.
And when I was training, I absorbed, or it was imparted to me, or maybe both, this idea that by the time I would be where I am now, I would feel comfortable with everything, right? And certainly I am more comfortable in that I have been through more pieces of dirt and I've been in bad places and I know how to get myself out of them. But what you said is so important if you're anywhere on this arc, which is that's actually not true, right? If you're pushing yourself and your team, you should be at the edge of what's working.
Yeah, you will always be uncomfortable. If you're not uncomfortable, I think that you have to have a serious worry. Because, I mean, you don't want to be paralyzed with fear and worry all the time. But, you know, if you get to the point where you think you know it all, then that's time to stop. Well, that's long after the time. And all these experts I've talked to when writing this book all pretty much said that there's no point when you know that you've known enough and you can then just sit down cross-legged and carry on doing it, because it doesn't work like that. And, you know, this is an unattainable goal, but just because it's unattainable and you know it's unattainable is not a reason for not trying to attain it.
Absolutely. And in doing so, to inexorably alter yourself as a human being at the same time, right? To evolve along with your work.
I think that's the bit that's easy to miss, that you can think of people who are expert in terms of the nature of the work that they do. And of course, that is crucial. That's what you're looking at. but it's easy to overlook what is happening inside them, because it's easy to see that they seem to have reached a sort of stable performance asymptote, as Erickson would talk about it, you know, where they get as good as they can possibly get, and then they carry on doing excellent work from then onwards. But actually, the ones who are really expert have not reached that. They are always continually pushing to do things better. And that doesn't mean that they're not doing good work already. It just means that they never feel that they've done their best work. And that's what you want, really, isn't it? I think.
So good. Roger, thank you so much for coming on the podcast and talking with me about this. I hope that this is the first of multiple conversations with us about this. I very much hope so.
It's been fascinating, Dan. Yeah. It's made me think all sorts of aspects of this that I hadn't thought about before. So thank you so much for inviting me.
The pleasure is mine, and I'm sure everybody listening. As we're closing out, I want to give you the chance, if you want to talk to the folks directly and any sort of a challenge you want to give them, anything you want them to try differently or think about differently when they're at their shop, whatever that shop is tomorrow, and to give you a little padding time to think that through if you want. I'm going to put my disclaimer I always put in at the end of this, which is that we're here to figure out the best of what humanity knows about applying knowledge under pressure. We're here to chase expertise, to keep going for that asymptote and to keep pushing ourselves and our teams into those spaces where we feel uncomfortable. We do this as individuals, not as representatives of any of our groups that we work with. We're just out here in space trying to make ourselves and the world better. I hope that as you're listening to this, this has planted some seeds in your mind and in your work, and I hope that you view your work differently tomorrow as you keep going. Roger, anything you want to toss at folks?
Just to say, really, I think that if whatever we're doing, we are somewhere on, I would see it, on a path towards becoming, towards continuing to become more and more expert. And that discomfort and often fear and insecurity, all those things are part of it. And so if we can think of ways of continuing to challenge ourselves without degrading the quality of the work that we've already reached, and not taking irresponsible risks, but nonetheless continuing to push ourselves, that inevitably involves discomfort, but that is a creative discomfort. And that is a discomfort that's well worth enduring, because that's the way we continue to evolve.
I love it. Thank you so much, sir.
Thank you.